From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 13th day of July 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities. He's in Newmarket, Indiana. And later in the program, Stephen Platt of Archer Financial Services will join us to take up the agricultural energy markets. Also in this half hour, we'll hear from the USDA statisticians in Illinois, Nebraska, and Minnesota. And in just 26 minutes, meteorologist Don Day will be here to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. In the second half hour of our program, on many of these stations, and always online at willag.org, we'll talk with Harry Baumus of USDA's Energy Policy and New Uses section. So stay with us for this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago on this Tuesday afternoon, futures finished the day with the wheat futures higher. July contract at $6.35, or rather at $5.35 and three quarters, up 14 and a half. September at $5.49 and a quarter, up 13 and a half. And December at $5.78 and a quarter, up 14 cents. July hard red in Kansas City at $5.62 and a quarter, up 12 and a quarter cents. And then we get to the red back in Chicago. July futures in the corn pit, $3.66 and three quarters, down 4.5 cents. September at $3.75 and a quarter, 4.5 lower. December at $3.87. That's down 4.75 from the March contract at $3.99 and a quarter, down 4.25. May futures there at $4.07.5, down 3.75. July beans at $10.30.5, a penny and a quarter lower. August at $9.95, down 2.75. September at $9.67, up 0.5 cent. November beans 3.5 higher at $9.54.5, and the January at $9.63.5, up 3.5 cents. July bean meal at $3.12.90, down $1.90. The August at $2.97. down $3.80. July bean oil at $37.92, up 42. The August up 41 at $38.02. August live cattle futures $90.95, 87.5 higher. The October at $92.27.5, up 87.5 as well. August feeders at $113.62.5, up 95 cents. The September's at $113.87.5, a buck 2.5 higher, and the lean hogs at the July contract, $78.02.5, down a dime. August down a dime at $79.35. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Futures in the crude oil in the August contract, $77.15 a barrel. They're up $2.20. September at $77.59, up $2.15. Actually, the August contract up $2.20. Ethanol futures at $1.57, down a penny and 2 cents. Natural gas at $4.37 and 3 cents, down a penny and a half for the day. The RBOB gasoline at $2.08 and 1/10 of a cent, 5 3/10 of a cent higher. And diesel fuel or August contract in the heating oil at $2.04 and 7 cents of a cent, up 5 6/10 of a cent. Gold futures at $1,213.30, a troy ounce, up $14.80. In the Dow now at 10,372, just about 155 points higher. The Goldman Sachs at 505.91 is up 11.2 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like as it comes from our own Drew Lerner on the day. Scattered showers today, again, Thursday into Friday as well. They'll offer, though, some limited relief to that recent drying. Better rain potential may evolve, says Mr. Lerner, in the drier areas from east-central Illinois to northwestern Ohio and southeastern Michigan this weekend. However, that said, the rainfall will be light, and there'll be a need for greater rain as the time passes. Temperatures will be seasonable with slightly warmer biases in the first week of the forecast. A high-pressure ridge still being advertised for next week. No models are agreeing, though, over where that ridge will locate or where it will produce the greatest heat and dryness. We'll take a more complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media in Urbana-Champaign.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Monday afternoon. On the phone line with us today is Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Wayne.
Why, good afternoon, Todd.
Let's talk about the marketplace just a bit. As you look around your area, first, did farmers take advantage of the pop in the market over the last several weeks to move the end or most of the end of the corn crop that they either had in the bin or in storage at the elevator?
A lot of corn has been moving out of storage over the last 2 weeks in our area, Todd. Cargill-Linden has had steady lines over the last few days or over the last few weeks. I know the other local elevator has been taking in a great amount of corn, too. So there was a lot of corn that did move over the last 2 weeks.
And do they have much left? And of that corn that moved, did you hear very much about its condition?
It wasn't very good.
Well, that probably makes some sense. So now we're faced with the idea that producers may have corn that's still out of condition or going out of condition. We have the heat in the Midwest, and we have had for quite some time. And the question is, should they wait it out at this point, or do they need to go ahead and push that into the marketplace?
Well, I think there's two things to look at there, Todd. Number one, if it is questionable as far as condition, move it. And I think that in many places would ever be more than happy to give you free DEP if it's still in good shape rather than waiting a while and getting it bad. The other thing is, you know, we looked here today. We've still got plenty of old crop corn on hand. We've got questions about next year's corn because of the size of the crop. You know, the ratings are good for what's out there. It's just how much is actually drowned up or how much are we going to actually be able to harvest. But, you know, so I think that we want to go ahead and move the old crop corn, if at all possible, at this point in time.
No, the ratings from the United States Department of Agriculture, and we'll hear more about those in just a bit. A bit surprising. They came up this week as opposed to going down. Did that surprise you very much?
I think it surprised most everybody, Todd. I think, but the thing we have to remember is we were overly wet in a lot of areas, and we had dry weather, and as a lot of that stuff dried out, it gets a little better looking. And, you know, if nothing else, it clearly defines what was in the pond and what wasn't and what's going to be really sort of the scale back or highly damaged on the edge of the ponds. But our corn looks immensely better since a week of dry weather, and I think it does in a lot of other places in the U.S. But we've still got some nitrogen deficiencies through the whole Midwest in different areas.
And so it's all about the acreage at this point. And then I suppose if we just put the normal yield on, do you think that the price of corn at this point and the range that USDA has topping out at 405 on the cash side will hold the marketplace?
Well, I think that that's going to depend an awful lot on the weather the rest of the summer. And I think that if we have the weather that's basically forecast today as we go home from the market, which is, you know, somewhat friendly as far as growing conditions, that it probably will. You know, if we would get that blocking ridge to come in for 2 weeks, the end of July, the first 2-3 weeks of August combined, why, we would probably go up and hit the 420 mark.
Okay, then let's turn our attention to the soybean market for just a bit. We have a 360 million bushel predicted carryout. By the time we get to the fall of next year, that is a very large carryout compared to what we have had and what we do have at this point for this coming year. The price of soybeans in the November contract at $9.54.5 today, does that tell you that producers ought to think about moving more soybeans than usual at this time of year?
Well, we think they should have thought about moving them a lot more when we had said 10 instead of 9. But the one thing that probably is going to be the upside target in the soybeans, to quote Dan Bossi, is whatever price the South American farmers find attractive enough to sell some of their massive supplies, and that'll probably top the market. But then again, we also have, you know, our main development type of beans is yet to come, and the weather is very important. And we've got a lot of acres of beans out. We've got a good soaking rain down in the Delta area in the Mid-South. And then we've got a lot of areas that the beans just are small yet, and they've got a long ways to go to maturity.
Do we have an idea where that sales point for the South American farmer might be, where he might, that farmer might be able to make money and be willing to let go of the crop that they have on storage?
You know, I'm not sure, but I would have to have thought that we should have been getting close to it with the way that the July beans reacted, the high basis levels. You know, I think that we look today, we seem to have topped out the July. Of course, that goes off the board tomorrow, six-month highs. And after we got there, well, that seemed to be a point where commercials maybe let some of the people they had trapped out, is what it looked like to me.
Anything else to add before I let you go for the day?
Well, I think basically the wheat market was the big surprise, and that seemed to be just short covering by the funds, Todd. And then, of course, the beans was a reversal of the spreads that they've been putting on, the bull spreads just being unwound.
Anything else on the wheat that I need to know before we go? Just the short covered?
I think basically we'll look tomorrow and see if the open interest didn't drop. We think it dropped quite sharply today after the way that the market went up.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Wayne Nelson is with L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report. That happens each and every Tuesday afternoon. You can listen to Wayne again if you'd like on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find all of our daily agricultural programming, from the pre-opening market report to the Closing Market Report and everything in between, including our weekend look at the marketplace. We call that one Commodity Week. It's all for free at willag.org. You can listen to it anytime you'd like as a podcast directly from the website. You can also sign up for our free weekend newsletter over on the right-hand side of the page. When we return, we'll take a complete look at the USDA state statistician numbers from Minnesota, Nebraska, and Illinois.
Learned Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learned Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learned Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
USDA yesterday released the latest crop progress report. It showed that nationally, 38% of this year's corn crop was at or beyond the silking stage by week's end, 23 points ahead of last year, 12 points ahead of the rolling five-year average. Silking was at or ahead of normal in all of the 18 producing states, with the exception of Colorado, Nebraska, and South Dakota. In Indiana and Ohio, ample soil moisture levels and warm weather in recent weeks pushed progress to 38 and 32 percentage points ahead of normal, respectively. Overall, 73% of the corn crop reported in good to excellent condition. That's up 2 points from the ratings last week and from the same time last year. In Iowa, the percentage of the crop rated good to excellent increased 6 points from last week as the crop benefited from drier weather. On the soybeans, blooming advanced 17 points last week at a rapid progress, and that was promoted by the hot, sunny weather in many of the major soybean-producing areas. By the week's end, 40% of the bean crop was at or beyond the blooming stage, 18 points ahead of last year, 3 points ahead of the five-year average. Pod set underway in all of the 18 major producing states, with the exceptions of Kansas and Wisconsin. Mississippi was the most advanced in the pod-setting stage of development at 68%. They're 14 points ahead of last year, 5 points ahead of the five-year average. Overall, 65% of the bean crop reported in good to excellent condition. That's down slightly from the ratings the previous week and from the same time last year. Now, here are updates from the statisticians in Illinois, Nebraska, and Minnesota.
This is Brad Schwab, Chief Crop Statistician with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending July 11th. Above normal temperatures and rainfall were welcomed weather patterns across most of Illinois last week, allowing corn pollination and soybean blooming to make excellent progress. Growing degree day units since May 1 ended the week at 1,476, which was 130 units, or 10%, ahead of the historic average. Statewide, corn in the silking stage advanced to 72% compared to 10% last year and 41% for the five-year average. 8% of the corn crop was reported in the dough stage compared with 3% for the five-year average. Overall, the corn crop was rated in 65% good or excellent condition, down 3 percentage points from last week. The crop reporting district leading the state in corn maturity was the southeastern district, where 39% was reported in the dough stage. Soybean blooming progress ended the week at 43% complete, and this compares to 10% last year and 38% for the five-year average. 6% of soybeans have begun setting pods compared to 3% a year ago and 5% for the five-year average. Overall, the soybean crop was rated in 62% good or excellent condition, up 3 points from last week. Soft red winter wheat harvest was winding down at 95% complete, compared to 82% last year and 89% for the five-year average. This has been Brad Schwab with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service with the crop weather report for the week ending July 11, 2010. Rainfall delayed wheat harvest in western counties and limited the need for irrigation. The rain and mild temperatures aided corn development as the crop entered the pollination stage. Soybean fields were sprayed for weeds and hay was harvested. Wind and hail this week again caused damage to scattered fields. Irrigated corn conditions rated 86% good or excellent, and dry land corn rated 87% good or excellent, both above year-ago levels. Corn silked was at 26% ahead of last year but behind average. Soybeans blooming were 38% complete, and the first fields were setting pods. Wheat harvest was 22% complete, behind last year's 26% and 47% average. The first sorghum field started to head, and the first dry bean fields were starting to bloom. Proso millet planting was at 97% complete. Oat harvest is 7% complete, equal to last year, but behind the 21% average. This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
This is Dan Loftus, Deputy Director for the USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office, with the weekly crop weather report for July 11, 2010. Above-average temperatures have been beneficial for crops and helped to dry damp fields. As of July 11th, topsoil moisture supplies were rated 23% surplus. This is down from 32% last week. Drier conditions were beneficial for haying and spraying in some areas. Statewide, 4.9 days were rated suitable for field work. Crop conditions were generally unchanged from last week. A few respondents noted that the continued heavy rains have caused yellowing and uneven crop growth in isolated areas. Overall, corn was rated 57% good and 31% excellent in condition, while soybean conditions were rated in 62% good and 21% excellent. Corn silking was 14% complete, on pace with the five-year average. Corn average height was 61 inches. 35% of soybeans were blooming, while 2% were setting pods, both on pace with average. Soybean height was 17 inches. For the USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office, this is Dan Loftus.
And I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is a Tuesday afternoon.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Listening to the Closing Market Report, I'm Todd Gleason, taking a look now at the agricultural energy markets on this Tuesday afternoon, as we always do. Stephen Platt of Archer Financial Services, it's an ADM affiliate, joins us from his Chicago offices. Good afternoon to you, Steve.
Good afternoon.
Let's start with the price of corn and ethanol margins, because corn has rallied pretty substantially over the last 3 to 4 weeks.
Yes, we've certainly seen them move back into the red here with the corn market rallying up and the ethanol price actually remaining somewhat flat, although it did pick up today. So we're probably moving back toward a break-even situation in terms of the ethanol price. With the crude price up here today as much as $2, and the gasoline price also showing some strong gains, I think that will help underpin that ethanol price as well.
You think that the ethanol industry has started to, the corn ethanol industry, that is, has started to show some maturity in the marketplace?
Yes, I would have to say that there's certainly some of those that were able to buy some of the assets on the cheap when things were tough maybe over a year ago are certainly doing better than those who've been in the business for a while. And that certainly is a strong dichotomy. There's the haves and have-nots, as we've seen throughout the whole economy.
Do you suspect that there is still some consolidation then yet to come in the ethanol
industry? Would not be surprised. Certainly, there's certain producers that probably are still being pressed and will not be able to sustain margins moving into the red for very long.
What are the other influences in the energy market at this point? And maybe we can take up two different things. There's the European Union and its inability to get along at this point. And then, of course, what's happening in the Gulf.
Correct. First of all, the European situation is still in the background, but has become less of a force as some stability returned there. The euro has certainly rallied, and that's helped underpin, I think, the energy price overall and other prices as well, as the dollar sold off relative to the euro on that stabilization. That certainly has helped provide some more optimism in terms of the crude price. Today we did move through some pretty key averages and are working back up toward the 100-day average here in terms of crude. In terms of the Gulf problems that we've seen in terms of the moratorium possibly becoming a factor once again. Its impact is really going to be felt more longer term rather than in the near term in terms of drilling. And also, certainly, many of these companies are going to be looking at their investment budgets and whether they want to. There certainly is going to be a higher cost and a tighter regulatory environment that will be a constraint on drilling.
And then finally, let's wrap up our discussion. Do you have any advice for producers on locking in fuel prices for their fall needs?
Well, it seems like this diesel price and heating oil price has some real solid support as we move back down toward the $2 area. Today's action is certainly noteworthy. I don't think we're going to be sharply higher in terms of the market moving up toward that $90, $100 area in terms of crude and heating oil doing the $240, $250 area. But I certainly see the market possibly getting toward the $230 on the heating oil, and probably would look on weakness in this market to maybe do some coverage for maybe the 2011 crop.
All right. Thank you so much, Stephen. Stephen Platt is with Archer Financial Services. He joins us from the Chicago office. That is an ADM affiliate. You're listening to the Closing Market Report on this Tuesday afternoon. In just a couple of minutes, we'll talk with Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. And then in the second half hour of the program, we call that The Farming World, Harry Bomas will be here. He will help us take a look at new uses for corn and ethanol. And then, of course, energy policy. Harry Bomas is acting undersecretary at the United States Department of Agriculture. Stay with us.
It's National Ice Cream Day. It's also National French Fries Day. As early as the 1680s, potatoes were fried in the Spanish Netherlands. French fry recipes began showing up in U.S. cookbooks as early as 1813, but date back in French cookbooks to at least 1755. On this day in agricultural history in 1568, the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral developed a method to bottle beer. In 1779, William Hedley was born, an English coal mine official and inventor. He was probably the first to build a commercially viable steam engine dependent on friction between the wheels and rails, as opposed to a geared track. In 1794, James Lynn died. Lynn was a Scottish physician who recommended that fresh citrus fruit and lemon juice be implemented in the seamen's diet to eliminate scurvy. Sir Gilbert Blane made Lynn's suggestion a requirement, and scurvy was eradicated in the British Navy. By the way, the Dutch had been using citrus to combat scurvy since at least 1594, 2 centuries earlier. And in 1937, the first Krispy Kreme donut was sold in Salem, North Carolina. The first donuts went to grocery stores, but it was not long before people began stopping by Vernon Rudolph's donut operation and asking for hot donuts to go. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a Tuesday afternoon. Don Day is with us. He's with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, to take up the agricultural weather forecast. Hey, right here locally, we got a heck of a downfall this morning. A lot of rain poured in on us. It looks to me like there was quite a little bit of rainfall to the east of us as well.
Yeah, and we're going to be looking at a couple of weather systems that will be setting off these showers and thunderstorms off and on here for the remainder of the week. But everything we're seeing, Todd, both in the short term and in the long term, looks about, well, as it should. There's really nothing extraordinary developing with our summertime pattern here as we look ahead over the next few weeks.
No, that's actually probably good news rather than bad news, because if something's out of the ordinary at this time of year, it's not rainfall usually, although that's not been the case as of the latter several years. It's usually drier weather. Are we still concerned at all about some building pressure out to the west?
Well, we are, but the way things seem to be setting up is that the high pressure won't be so strong to completely stymie the threat of occasional shower and thunderstorm activity moving through. So I think what we're going to have is a nice, happy medium of good temperature conditions to get some heat units accumulated, and the occasional threat of shower and thunderstorm activity that won't be continuous, but spaced apart every 2 to 3 to 4 days. The center of high pressure looks like it's going to be setting up over the southern plains, Oklahoma, East Texas, and that's where it will likely reside, well, probably into early August. And that will allow moisture to rotate around that high coming up out of the Gulf of Mexico, through the Rockies, through the northern plains, then come back down around again into the Midwest and Corn Belt, giving us off and on chances for precipitation. If there's going to be some dry areas developing that we need to look out for, I would certainly say it's going to be maybe some of those southern plains areas.
Our growing degree days are running about 10% ahead. Those came earlier in the season. Likelihood that we'll stay that far ahead for quite some time now?
I certainly do see that, which I think is good news. Would rather be ahead than behind this time of year, that's for sure. And while it's too early to talk about the end of the season and the fall season, the trend over the last couple of years has been for the fall season and the cooler weather to get a bit of an earlier start. So that's something that's in the back of our minds right now.
The season in China has not been particularly good. What's your assessment?
Well, it's going to continue to be a little bit rocky. They're going to continue to have quite a bit of thunderstorm and rain shower and thunderstorm activity over most of China off and on. This is going to be a pattern that's going to keep temperatures countrywide darn close to most of the country below normal. So their heat unit accumulation isn't going to be good, and there'll be some areas that are going to be a little too wet.
Don, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Don Day is with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Tuesday afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason. If you can stay with us today for the farming world, please do. If not, visit us online at willag.org. You can hear the farming world in the second half of the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Rob O'Malley in Champaign at 217-378-7633. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Harry Bomas. He's the Acting Director of Energy Policy and New Uses in the Office of the Chief Economist at USDA. Mr. Bomas, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And tell me about your role there in the Chief Economist Office and what you do.
Okay, well, the office itself, as the name suggests, is a policy office. We report to the chief economist, who in turn reports into the Secretary of Agriculture. A key role that we play is in the evaluation of particularly energy policies or renewable energy policies and how they might impact agriculture in general, as well as we play a role in a coordination role across the department in terms of coordinating renewable energy activities and bio-based product activities as well. And we also have, I call it an outreach function in that, you know, we interface with, you know, stakeholders in renewable energy, be those consumers who are utilizing ethanol in their fuel tanks or industry folks or the media.
I imagine you have been busy in recent months dealing with many things. I would suspect much of it has to surround the ethanol issues. What are the topics that you've been taking up on a daily basis?
Well, renewable energy. I know it's a broad topic, but you know, we have been busy, and I actually refer to it, Todd, as a bio frenzy, but in a good sense. You know, we have been looking at ways to produce feedstocks and the types of feedstocks that could be used to produce renewable energy. You know, as you suggested in the questions, ethanol receives a lot of attention here. But biodiesel receives a fair amount of attention as well. We have been working with the EPA, and actually today's a good day for the interview because the new renewable fuel standards that were mandated in the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007 become effective today. So we're operating in quote, a new world, if you will. But that's certainly been the bulk of our activities over the recent months. So as well as, you know, we look at other types of market development issues with respect to bio-based products and growing demand for agricultural products and things of that sort.
You act in an advisory capacity to both, I suppose, the chief economist and then eventually to the Secretary of Agriculture. Do they always take your advice?
Not always. Not always. I mean, that's the, you know, we try and provide objective analysis when we put forward our evaluations and assessments. You know, but the secretary is the guy in charge, and he may or may not take our advice, or he may ask a slightly different question. But again, sometimes, you know, whoever's doing the cost-benefit analysis, if you will, in terms of maybe taking a position, you know, weighs different factors, and you know, their weighting may be different than just looking at, okay, here's the numbers. This is what it means in terms of, say, a corn price or an ethanol price or how much corn might be used in ethanol production or in other types of production.
And your office also reaches out to other departments within the agency and to other departments, for instance, US EPA and the DOE?
Sure. We have worked very closely, actually, with the EPA in recent months, really since the implementation or enactment, rather, of the Energy Independence Security Act. EPA was charged with the monumental task of you know, trying to write the rules for implementation of this act. And, you know, there's a lot of agriculture in terms of where that renewable biomass is going to be coming from to produce fuels. And so as a consequence, we've been involved in working closely with both EPA and DOE.
Have you also been involved with the so-called blend wall or the E10, E15 debate?
Well, we've provided some information and analysis. You know, as far as the E15 waiver request that Growth Energy submitted to Administrator Jackson and EPA, I know the agency has certainly been involved at the policy or the political level in discussions. I don't think it's any secret that our secretary supports raising the blend level, whether it's to E15 or some other level, but he does support that. But the issue right now with the E15 is a testing issue for the vehicles, and we are not involved in the testing of the vehicles. That's a Department of Energy responsibility. That said, you know, a couple of years ago when Governor Perry of Texas requested a waiver of the RFS standard at the time, or RFS level at the time, I believe it was 50% waiver, we were very much involved in the analysis that was provided to EPA looking at the effects of, you know, reducing the requirement or the mandate and, you know, what the implications might be on agriculture in terms of commodity prices and farm revenues and consumer prices.
I have heard that there seems to be some discussion on the policy side of whether U.S. EPA actually has the authority to move that mandate from one place to the other. Have you had any advisory capacity in whether the legalities of this issue can be actually taken up by U.S. EPA?
I'm not real sure I'm qualified to answer that question, in all honesty.
That's a legal issue,
and whether they have the authority or not.
Has it been discussed there on the Hill?
I can't say for certain.
Okay.
I imagine it's one of the issues if it's been brought up. But I know that EPA has been petitioned, and there are some inquiries being made as to the legalities of some of the things. But again, I'm not sure where we stand on that, and I'm not an attorney, so I'm really not the one qualified to answer that.
That's perfectly fine. Let's go back to the uses. What kinds of new uses are you working on at this time?
Well, the federal government actually has a what's called a federal bio-based preferred product procurement program, which our departmental administration administers. And part of that is looking at there's a couple elements here. One is to identify what a bio-based product is. And, you know, in 2006, 2007, my office was involved in writing the rules for identifying what bio-based products were. Lubricants would be a good example. Cleansers would be a good example, or cleaners. And you know, I forget the exact number that were identified, but the rulemaking process identified items, which the items included a broad categorization. Again, like an item could be cleansers.
Right,
and underneath that general category, you could have industrial or commercial, and you know. But I think we've identified well over 2,000 bio-based products that could qualify under the federal procurement program.
And then these would be put into some sort of list, and then the agencies, the federal government, would be those people who are doing the purchasing would give priority to purchase those products?
Yeah, that's essentially correct, Todd. I mean, you know, the product itself has to compete on a price, and it has to meet the specs and quality, specs, and cost, I guess, are the three key items that we're looking at. So it does have to compete, but again, there would be preferential treatment given to those products that meet the requirements.
Has this been implemented yet?
Yeah, it was implemented, it was part of the 2002 Farm Bill.
Right.
And, you know, and departmental administration is implementing the program.
And has it been successful in any significant way?
Well, again, I'm not sure how you define significant way, but, you know, I do know that there are products being procured. So, but again, I don't have the specifics. When my office was more directly involved in the program and writing the rules and evaluating the products, it was at its very early stage. The program's really been, you know, let's see, if you look at the 2002 Farm Bill and then when we really got some of the rules off the ground, it's only been a couple years. So I would guess that in some areas there's been progress, in other areas it's a little more slow to come.
You've called the recent months earlier in this interview a bio frenzy. So, what are the topics you've taken up?
Well, bio frenzy in a sense that, and let me try and give you some historical perspective. When I first came to the Office of Energy Policy and New Uses as the associate director, and that was in April of 2006, And at that time, we had low corn prices, we had high fuel prices, and you know, there was talk on the Hill, and we had just had passed the Energy Policy Act of 2005. I think that was enacted in August of 2005, which set the first renewable fuel standard. Okay, and in that legislation, we were actually looking at consuming by 2012 7.5 billion gallons of renewable fuel. And again, at that time, you know, money was cheap. We had the technology, and so there was a real rapid buildup over the next year and a half, 2 years, in productive capacity for both biodiesel and ethanol, and corn-based ethanol. And you know, it was like, and then there was actually talk on the Hill of producing 60 gallons of renewable fuels. So it was really, it didn't matter which side of the aisle you were standing on, whether you're Republican or a Democrat or independent, there was this push to produce more and more. And, you know, and then in 2007, late 2007, 2008, we had high food prices, or what was construed as high food prices. We certainly had higher corn prices. Energy prices had started to come down, but they still remained relatively high as to where they were. We had some commodity shortages in looking at production in key regions around the world, Russia, the European Union. We had some countries stop exporting, and international prices went high. Argentina, Vietnam were good examples there. And, you know, as a consequence, you know, ethanol and biofuels kind of got a bad rap, I think, in causing high food prices. And as a consequence, you know, the Office of the Chief Economist did do some work and, you know, did indicate that, you know, in terms of our own food price inflation, there, you know, there was very modest impact on food price inflation in the U.S. that could be attributable to biofuels production. But in the international arena, there's a heavier weighting towards bulk commodities like corn. And as a consequence, higher prices of corn did push the global index higher. But here again, you had very, very high energy prices, and that was probably a greater culprit in pushing food prices higher.
And what impact did that have in Congress?
I think it's fairly certain. You had a bio frenzy pushing the other way, saying we've gone too far, we've gone too far. And by that time, the ESA had passed, and we were ramping up to, you know, consume 36 billion gallons of renewable fuels by 2022. And so you almost had a push going the other way, a biofrenzy. We got to stop this. We can't let it go on. And, you know, fortunately, you know, the market's kind of calmed down. We had some recoveries in productions in Australia and, again, in the European Union and, you know, some of those countries that, you know, had shortages or short crops the year before. Commodity prices have come down, you know, and we're, I forget the exact number, but, you know, in the U.S., about between 25 and 30% of our corn crop is going to be going into ethanol production, and our stocks and inventories are growing. So, you know, the market's recovered.
We're talking today with Harry Bamas. He's the Acting Director of Energy Policy and New Uses in the Office of the Chief Economist at USDA. More with him when we return here on The Farming World.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
It's National Ice Cream Day. It's also National French Fries Day. As early as the 1680s, potatoes were fried in the Spanish Netherlands. French fry recipes began showing up in U.S. cookbooks as early as 1813, but date back in French cookbooks to at least 1755. On this day in agricultural history in 1568, the Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral developed a method to bottle beer. In 1779, William Headley was born, an English coal mine official and inventor. He was probably the first to build a commercially viable steam engine dependent on friction between the wheels and rails, as opposed to a geared track. In 1794, James Lynn died. Lynn was a Scottish physician who recommended that fresh citrus fruit and lemon juice be implemented in the seamen's diet to eliminate scurvy. Sir Gilbert Blane made Lynn's suggestion a requirement, and scurvy was eradicated in the British Navy. By the way, the Dutch had been using citrus to combat scurvy since at least 1594, 2 centuries earlier. And in 1937, the first Krispy Kreme donut was sold in Salem, North Carolina. The first donuts went to grocery stores, but it was not long before people began stopping by Vernon Rudolph's donut operation and asking for hot donuts to go. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
This is the Farming World. It's news and interviews from the land grant in Urbana-Champaign. We're talking today with the Acting Director of Energy Policy and New Uses at USDA. His name is Harry Bomas. Mr. Bomas, thanks for joining us and staying with us this afternoon. Let's take up this biofuel frenzy just a bit more. So we've waxed and waned just a bit in the process, and it seems to be settling out. Do you think that Washington will have the stomach and that your advice to them will be to continue down the road? And in which directions might your office see the best economic fit?
Well, where we are right now is we have the Energy Independence Security Act and the Renewable Fuel Standard mandates that are the provisions of that act, indicating that by 2022, 36 billion gallons of renewable energy will be part of our fuel supply. To address the kind of food versus fuel debate, you know, the provisions of the ESA restrict how much cornstarch ethanol can be used in meeting the mandate, and that is capped at 15 billion gallons. Okay, and quite honestly, we pretty much have that capacity built today. Okay, I believe the figure is a little over 13.5 billion gallons of boilerplate capacity, with another 1.2 or thereabouts, 1.5 billion gallons of capacity under some level of construction. So we pretty much have that capacity in place today. What the new renewable fuel standard does, though, is it focuses on what we're calling advanced biofuels. And advanced being second and third generation, we're looking at cellulosic biofuels made from biomass. It could be grass clippings, it could be crop residues, it could be algae, it could be a number of municipal solid waste. I mean, there are a number of possibilities here. And it's key to continue research and developing the technologies, because unfortunately at today's date, we don't have a commercial cellulosic plant in existence in the U.S. today. So we need to continue working on the technologies to make that a reality.
Your office is charged, I think, in part at looking at efficiencies in corn use for ethanol. What are you finding or looking at?
Well, we're not charged specifically in doing that, but we have some ongoing research in that area. And as a matter of fact, we recently released a study by one of my colleagues, and it's available on our website at USDA. If you click on the Office of Energy Policy and New Uses, you can download it. But it's titled the 2008 Energy Balance for the Corn Ethanol Industry. And one of the authors, Hossein Shapouri, has actually been involved in three or four of these studies. And what we have found over time is that our farmers, our technology, are becoming much, much more energy efficient in how they produce corn. So if you look at how we produce corn in 2000, and say in 1980 when we first started producing ethanol, it took more energy to produce ethanol. And that's looking at going from the seed we plant, the fertilizer we use, and processing, you know, really from the fields to the ethanol going into the gas tank. We used more energy in producing that gallon of ethanol than it yielded. Now, through technology gains, better seed stocks, higher yielding varieties, better cultural practices, we have continually improved on that energy return, if you will. And right now, I believe it was 2002, it was about for every unit of energy that we used to produce ethanol, the ethanol yielded 1.76 units of energy in return. Now in 2008, we find that that ratio has risen to 2.3. So for every unit of energy going into a dry mill ethanol facility, every unit of energy going into a dry mill produces 2.3 units of energy in the output side from ethanol. So it's come from two places. One is in the producing of corn, as well as in the technology that we're using in the dry mill. We're more efficient there.
Well, so the efficiency and so the people can understand, because most people will say, well, how do you get more energy out than you can actually put in? But it's the sun's energy, I suppose, that accounts for.
That's your original source. And in 1980, we were getting closer to 2 gallons of ethanol per bushel of corn. In 2010, we're getting closer to 2.8 gallons of ethanol per bushel of corn. So that's almost, a 50% increase right there, just in how much ethanol we can extract from that corn. And, plants are very efficient at converting, the sun's energy.
Have you done work to suggest that it can get better than that?
We think it can get better than that. Part of the production technology in terms of the physical plant, the physical plant requires energy to operate. If we use our biomass to fire that plant to produce the heat and power, we can improve on that even more, that ratio even more. And, estimates rise as high as a one unit input to as high as maybe 25 units of output.
That's Harry Bomas, Acting Director of Energy Policy and New Uses in the Office of the Chief Economist at the United States Department of Agriculture. He joined us here on this edition of The Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.